Hello and welcome to another English edition of my podcast Helium Talk, das Kunstgespräch. My name is Jörg Heikhaus and here I am talking with master brewer Oliver Wesselow. Olli is the founder of his brewery Kehrwieder Kreativbrauerei here in Hamburg. He won the title of world champion of beer sommeliers and not only in my eyes is one of the best in the field. So what's with all the beer and why do I talk about this in an art podcast? Well, Olli and I are releasing our second so-called artist beer, a beer that we have created and brewed together. Our artist beers always come in a very limited edition and in a box that also contains a high-end silkscreen print of the label artwork. Our first creation came out in 2016 and was called The Dirty Hands of Alex Diamond. It was a smoke porter, a workman porter as Olli and I labeled it. It was strong and dark and meant to be enjoyed after a long hard day at work. That one of course is gone and sold out and drunk empty by now, so it was time for a new badge of hoppy craziness. This year we call it the Love Me or Die. The story behind the beer and the artwork was inspired by a great song of the same name by one of my biggest musical discoveries of recent years, C.W. Stone King. I've tried to contact the man himself many times, but could never reach him, though he likes our posts on the social web, and I guess he might be aware of the praise for his song in liquid form and in fine arts by Olli and me. His music is a pure gem, and in the meantime the gentleman has gained the deserved success and is touring with the Queens of the Stone Age, and I guess there's not much time left for responding to us now. But just in case, if you hear this Mr. Stone King, or one of your team, we just need an address where you can send one of the boxes to, cause you getting a taste of this beer would mean the world to Olli and me. Until then, let's do this podcast.
Helium Talk.
How's our beer? How does it taste?
Awesome, interesting, weird, different. It really works for the title, The Love Me or Die. So, well, we might talk about the beer first, what it is. It is a spiced triple, Belgian style triple, that we have spiced with aniseed, ginger, wormwood, and tonka sugar, tonka beans. It combines. It's like a two-hearted or two-faced beer. On one hand, it has the sweetness, this playful, enchanting, sweetness of the tonka beans that greet you on the nose, on the palate initially, and then the wormwood takes over with its own pretty unique bitterness, which is quite different from the hop bitterness that you're used to in your everyday IPA. I think it really works for the title. You really love it, or well, hopefully, I guess nobody was going to die from it. But if you don't love it, you really think it's. I think there's nothing
the beer
in between.
Dies for you. Then I mean, the beer's over. It's gone. If you don't like it, this is the thing with taste. But the background of the story of this beer is it's a song that I stumbled across. Mm-hmm. I think a year ago, 2 years ago, when I was introduced to an artist called C.W. Stone King, an Australian blues artist who plays blues like he would be still living in the 20s, 30s, 40s.
Yeah.
He's an amazing musician. You should check him out. And he has one song on one of his records. It's called, on his record Jungle Blues, it's called The Love Me or Die. And that is basically the story of that song. It's about a voodoo spell. It's this... The narrator is in love with a woman that Matilda that he wants to marry her, but she doesn't want to marry him. She's not interested in him. So he goes as his last resort. He goes and gets this voodoo charm called the Love Me or Die, and that voodoo charm is basically you put it under the floor of the door or the house of the woman that you love or the man that you love. They want to love you. And the next day, this person either loves you,
it decides,
or is dead, or is dying. And in the case of the song, it ends very badly. Matilda dies. It's very, very sad. But I like the atmosphere of the song. I like the story behind it for everything it stands for, not just this specific story. But I think Ollie and I were with what we're doing with beer and art. We're storytellers in a way as well.
For sure.
So this kind of fit very well. And last year I created an artwork from wood. A large artwork that was already labeled "The Love Me or Die," and as a centerpiece, it has the carriage,
the hearse.
Yeah, the hearse, exactly. That takes away Matilda's dead body, and that's also on the label artwork and on the cover.
Yeah.
And when I approached Ollie with this story and with this artwork and with the song too. We sat down and thought about what kind of beer this could be. And this is basically where more of your artistic knowledge and craft and everything comes in, because I can have these ideas and I can say this is probably a way that it could go. I love the one of your first thought with the aphrodisiac
ingredients,
yeah. And stuff like that. But that's basically where we started to create a very unique beer.
Initially sketch it up initially just to get the rough outlines. Probably like when you started creating the artwork, I mean, you make sketches initially, you're not starting on the artwork from scratch.
No, sure.
So yeah, it was the same idea to say, okay, it has to be something charming. It has to be something that really, you know, might make you fall in love. So that's why we decided for the Belgian triple as a base beer style, because it has, on one hand, it is it's this nice higher alcohol beer, yet quite drinkable, quite easy to drink. It has some of this like honey sweetness, a little bit like a peppery spiciness that you get from this Belgian yeast styles. And it's triple is a good triple is kind of deceiving it, because you do not get the strength of the alcohol in the first couple of sips, but well, it'll show after a while. we tasted some and decided like, well, this might be a good base, and then said, okay, if you want someone to fall in love with you, or actually in a way enforce it. I mean, this is what it's about, right? It's not like it's using like a crowbar to get somebody to fall in love with you. So that was the second step to say, okay, let's put stuff in there that's at least said to be aphrodisiac. Mm-hmm. We looked around and researched a bit what could work and what would work with the beer style in the end. We dropped one ingredient, the horny goat weed, just because it's not even...
For legal reasons.
It's for legal reasons. We would have done it if we... But this is just outside of any... it's not considered foodstuff in Germany, I think most of Europe.
It's more medicine.
So it's medicine, yeah. If we would have called it a medicine or maybe a love potion... And just sold it in pharmacies, then it might have worked, but not.
Yeah, we could have made the Viagra of beers, but yes. Then were to check.
Well, you got to try it. Actually, you got to try it. Maybe it still is. So, other than the horny goat weed, we decided for aniseed and ginger, and of course wormwood. Mm-hmm. And the aniseed and ginger, they're a bit more in the background. They're supporting. They're not so much. Ginger and both ginger and aniseed can be very strong, very powerful, but then they dominate the beer. And I think it's more intriguing to have these different layers in there that you can explore. Yet still, the wormwood is still pretty strong in there. Although we toned it back from the initial test batch that you tasted and pretty well remember, because the wormwood has this very unique bitterness to it. And that one was really, I mean, we probably both can take a lot in terms of beers, but that was, you could drink it, but that was like, challenging, I would say, the bitterness back then.
All I can say is that I took one, what do you call them, growlers? Growler?
Yeah.
I think
growler,
2.5 liters bottle with me up north to a friend
That's
of mine.
Right.
And we shared it one evening, and it was actually good. We liked it. We enjoyed it.
Did you get horny?
No, I think we just got drunk.
Right.
In the end. But of course, you know, it's different. It's a different approach when you make a beer, when you like the beer, when you're with good friends and stuff like that. That's the thing for me. I'm an artist, and of course, I'm always nervous, not necessarily nervous, but curious to see how people react to my work. Mm-hmm. But I am an artist for so many years that I'm pretty strong in what I present, so I know that the work I'm doing is, you know, sort of the best I can. So I'm not nervous that anybody says, "Oh, I don't like this." Then it's fine. Nobody has to like it. But with making a beverage and making a beer, it's totally different. Especially because with beer, with art, it's sometimes people say, "Well, I don't know anything about art, so I don't want to judge." But everybody knows about beer. You know, and I think
everybody thinks, you know.
Yeah, but everybody has an opinion about beer.
Yeah, that's right.
So the last beer that we did, the Dirty Hands of Alex Diamond, I was already nervous, but that went extremely well.
Yes.
Nobody was complaining. With this one, you know, it might be a little bit different, but it's a polarizing beer and it's a polarizing story, and that's also the idea behind the beers when we decided to make this together. It's basically, we said we're making an artist beer.
That's right.
And the artist beer means that it's not just a nice label artwork, and the bottle looks good and the content is done by Oli and I do the label artwork, but it's a shared effort.
Yeah.
The idea is to come together with throw around ideas, and then you have the artist helping with the process of brewing and the brewmaster helping with the story. That's why the print that comes with the artwork is signed by both of us. Mm-hmm. And you know, I claim that the beer is also mine, even though of course we have to admit
he is
the pro in Oli that without you it wouldn't be possible to make a beer like that. I could think.
Well, that's right.
But you developed the
input, the story, mm-hmm. Together, mm-hmm. based on your artwork, and I think that's the main part behind it. That's this shared effort. I mean, for the Dirty Hands, back then, we looked at your approach on art in general, mm-hmm. Your way of working, your credo to like always get your hands dirty when you're working,
mm-hmm.
This workman style porter, still rough working class beer style, smoked porter aged on the wood chips because you're working a lot predominantly with wood.
Yeah.
So, and in this case, it was more specific, a single piece of art, which again was inspired by another piece of art, mm-hmm. By a song. So it's actually, it's a nice link of pieces of art, because in the end, beer is also a piece of art if you make a good beer and a special beer.
Yeah, especially when you make it special and not just, you know, sort of like off-the-shelf product.
Right, yeah. I love this collaboration, and I'm really curious to see what comes out of that. How this series will still develop in the future, but still, so far, we still have to look forward to next week.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. I mean, it's always the same. Of course, you're nervous. Same for me. When you present something new.
I think
to see how people will like it, I don't have to like get everybody's liking, and especially with that beer, I expect people. It will split people. So some people will really love it.
Mm-hmm.
Some people will probably hate it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's fine, because people will talk about it,
mm-hmm.
and that's important, that they finally talk about beer again, and. It's great. So because if you have a polarizing beer like that, the people that love it really love it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's great to get them, because they will say, it's like, okay, this is like the most awesome beer I've ever had. It's not a beer for the stadium that you drink in pints, just five of them in a row. But to savor it and explore it, same like artwork. If you just, I mean, you're just not running by a couple of pictures. I mean, you're standing there, you look at them, you're trying to explore the picture. Same with that beer.
Yeah. And yeah, as you said, it's like a, I mean, I think it's experimental in many ways, and that's the beauty of it. And in it's something we can afford to do outside of what we're usually doing, you know, because it's a passion project as well. Your main project, I mean, our jobs are passion too. You know,
so totally. Yeah,
I think that's the thing.
But,
and fun. Yeah. Yeah, let's come to the point. I'm not sure whether everybody that listens to the podcast in English. I think when we did this, you know, first in German. I think here in Hamburg, Olli is very well known in the German craft beer scene. He's very well known with his brewery Kevida Kreativbrauerei, which is probably hard for Americans and English speaking people, right?
Just stick to Kevida.
Kevida, yeah,
that should Kevida, still work. Yeah.
The Kreativbrauerei is probably like the German word there.
Yeah, it's a, well, we use that Kreativbrauerei, basically, well, it translates into creative brewery. Mm-hmm. When we started back in 2011, there wasn't much going on in the craft beer scene in Germany. But however, we decided against using the wording craft beer, mm-hmm. Because it has been abused pretty fast from bigger breweries, like industrial breweries that wanted to be cool, mm-hmm. as well. You have the same issue in the US, what they call crafty. Mm-hmm. And also, I really hate it when I see this German-English combinations of craft beer. We have craft as the English word, but beer, the B-I-E-R, the German version, which is like, I just hate these German-English combinations. So we were looking for a German word that would convey the ideals, the goals of the craft brewing scene that I know from the US market, and decided for Kreativbrauerei. So that's basically just the addition for the brewery. So, yeah. But the main name is Kevida. So,
you know so much about the American craft beer scene because you've had the privilege of living there for many years, or yeah. being abroad and right. brewing in the Caribbean and in the United States.
Yeah, that was in a way a chance thing, which led to our kind of motto, it was our guiding tagline for our life. Mm-hmm. It's like everything happens for a reason. And after I finished studying brewing science, I started working in a small brew pub here in Hamburg. Then I went to Berlin to study brewing science, worked at two larger industrial breweries in Germany. And then when one of them had to cut down on jobs, I was one of them falling through the grid, and initially I was like just starting off my career, and just like, you know, this like whoa, was really I was had my like already like a heading the laboratory, and was like just out of university, like in career mode, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden I was like, oh shit, and what's happening now? But that led to brought me to the Caribbean all of a sudden, chance thing. Which then one thing led to another.
There was a job offering in the Caribbean.
There was a job offering. I just saw a small vacancy in a brewing magazine. It was like lab manager for the Caribbean. I was like, okay. So I called them and got the job. Initially, it was taken already, but the guy they sent there was a bad alcoholic, and so after a week they sent him back home. I was like, hey, you're still available? It's like, oh yeah, sure. Like, okay, well, when are you ready to travel? I was like, okay, let me see. Do I need any visas or, I don't know, vaccinations or whatnot? I was like, nah. We take care of the visa and that's fine. All right.
We take care of the visa.
Like, yeah. Like, I don't know, give me about a week's time or so. That, okay, fine, we're going to send you a ticket. Mm-hmm. And a week later, off I went to the before unknown island of Dominica, which is in the Eastern Caribbean between Martinique and Guadeloupe. Mm-hmm. Beautiful place, definitely. and started working there as a brewer, built the lab, and finally was their technical manager for the brewery.
You took your wife with there too?
Not back then. She was still working as a journalist in Germany, because initially I was supposed to go there for just for half a year to build up the lab. Mm-hmm. It turned out to be almost a full year. And when I came back, we got the next, kind of follow-on job, mm-hmm. In the Caribbean. And that's when she moved with me. That was on the Cayman Islands. To build a brewery there, and initially I was supposed to build up the brewery as the project manager, start it up, and then move on to Freeport on the Bahamas to do the next thing there. But in that job, it happens quite often that as a project manager you're asked to stay aboard, which happened on the Cayman Islands as well. So we stayed overall 3 years on Grand Cayman. Again, running the brewery as a technical manager, then moved to Guyana, formerly British Guyana, for another year to work for their local brewery, because they were brewing Beck's under license and they couldn't get the flavor profile right. So I spent another year in South America with a family. Brewing Beck's and some Caribbean lagers. And when that job was done, I coincidentally met the managing director of one of the three largest brewery equipment manufacturers, all three of them located in Germany. And he asked me whether I would be interested in supporting them in building up their sales office in Miami, mm-hmm. taking care of North America and the Caribbean. I was like, sure, of course. So we moved to Miami. And that's, by now I'm saying that's when I saw the light, because mm-hmm. I was, all of a sudden I was paid to travel the US craft beer scene, mainly to sell brew houses or fermenters. But as the lucky side effect, of course, after you had your sales meeting, in the evening you would sit down with the head brewer or the owner, or probably the same person, mm-hmm. And drink through the range of beers that they have and talk about them. And it, that was really, for me, that's inspiration. Of course, that's why I became a brewer. Because when you're trained in Germany, your typical training, it's very good. We have a very, very mm-hmm. good education system in brewing in Germany. It's excellent. However, it's only touching the German beer styles. So mm-hmm. You know everything about brewing a perfect Pilsner and a Hefeweizen and a Märzen or an export. But they only briefly, at least back then when I was studying, they only briefly touched British or Belgian beer styles. Mm-hmm. So you basically heard that these other beer styles, but not much into how to brew them. Never mentioned dry hopping or stuff like that. And all of a sudden I got in touch with that in the US market. And I was like, of course, this is what's brewing about. And
so they told you things you didn't know?
Of course, I learned stuff that I didn't know, mm-hmm. And tons of inspiration for sure.
Yeah.
And so, as a brewer, of course, you always want to brew your own beer. Mm-hmm. And so this idea started to take a hold and grow. And again, things changed. The managing director changed. The new one was really crap.
That happens.
Yeah, it happens. Mm-hmm. But everything happens for a reason, you know? So I sat down with my wife, Julia, and because I was looking at the German market as well back then, nothing was going on the German beer market mm-hmm. in terms of craft beer. They only had their traditional beer styles. And around the beginning of 2011, I noticed the first experiments are starting. So we sat down, said, okay, look, this is let's have a look at our situation that we have here in Miami. Do we really love it? I also had the challenge. It was probably as a bachelor, it's a great job because you're traveling a lot. You get a lot get to see a lot. As a father and a family man, it's kind of challenging because on Monday morning you're driving to the airport. You're gone for the whole weekend. Might come back on a Friday afternoon, or if you're at the West Coast, even on a Saturday.
Your first child was born in the States, or both of them?
No, Lisa, my first child was born on the Cayman Islands.
Okay.
And Zakaya, the second one, was born basically on a half year in between stop in Hamburg. So we looked at that, looked at the situation in the US, looked at the job situation. Of course, it was great living in Miami. I can't complain about that. We had a really beautiful place there, great friends. However, we also looked at the school system there, which is kind of challenging, mm-hmm. I'd like to say, and just on competition. It's just so we weren't sure whether we wanted that for our daughters either. So everything came, putting everything together, we said, okay, this could be the right time to start something like that in the German market. So let's make a decision. Do we want to do that or not? And we decided to do it. Basically scraped together everything, all our savings, quit the job, moved back to Germany, and started searching for locations, started building equipment, because back then it would have made no sense to go to a bank and ask them for money in order to build up a brewery, because back then there was no craft beer market in Germany. And in the general beer market, small breweries were dying. Mm-hmm. They would rather close than open.
Yeah.
So there would have been no chance to get money from anyone for it to open up a brewery in Germany. So the only chance was to, take all of our savings and build the stuff ourselves.
How's it now? Would the banks open their safe when you come and say, I want to make a craft brewery? Because now they know what that is. No, here in Germany, I mean. Come to Germany.
These days now?
Yeah.
I think they're more open these days, especially since you have all the big brewing groups in Germany. They're also now venturing into some sort of craft beer, mm-hmm. Ish. So I think that's a good proof. I mean, these big companies, they don't go into a niche if they're not expecting profit. Mm-hmm. And it's the only segment on the German beer market that shows a serious growth. Mm-hmm. When we needed a little bit more money last year to buy more tanks, more fermenters, it wasn't an issue at all. So that seems to work now. I'm going to find out.
It's always a good sign when the money flows, goes into those directions as well. That some kind of.
And if you're profitable, I mean, by now we are. Of course, not from the start, but it worked out fine for us. Mm-hmm. We started very low key, so we're still working basically on an ambitious homebrewing equipment. I'm sometimes saying it's like a. It's a small, but it does the job. It's really good.
That's a lot more than home brewing equipment that you have there. But I know, I don't know what you mean. It's still a small ship compared to other large breweries. But you also mentioned that you're already at a point where you think that you might sort of change spaces and stuff like that. Mm. So
that's typical growth. I mean, luxury problem, but. By now we're at the point where we maxed out our equipment, we maxed out the space that we're mm-hmm. located in. So we're right now searching for a new location bigger location. But so this is going to be interesting now because of that one. So the ideal planning would be to build a complete new brewery from scratch, mm-hmm. including the building. And of course, that's significantly more money than... we have saved in the last couple of years. So yes, we will have to try the banks on that. So this is going to be interesting, but I'm pretty positive. I think it all goes into the right direction. Actually, the search for location within Hamburg is the biggest challenge because there's hardly anything left. Mm-hmm. And if there are empty lots, they are just darn expensive. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah, they're going crazy.
And regrettably, a brewery needs a certain size. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Plus, you might need extra room, even if you don't need it initially. You need room to grow into, because there's nothing worse than being landlocked and you see like, okay, basically I could add more tanks or, I don't know, more storage space, but there is none.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all the planning question, because I'm not planning. I've seen that in the US market when I was working there, that some of these breweries, just because they had tremendous growth, like every 5 to 10 years, they had to build a new brewery. and actually, I like to brew beer. It's fun to build a new brewery, but I do not want to do that on a regular basis. I rather want to brew beer. So that's the biggest challenge, to find a space and get all that worked out in a way that hopefully I do not have to build another new brewery, just expand the one that we have, all goes well.
But that also means that the scene in Germany has kind of grown over these past years to a stage that that it's actually, I don't know whether it's a threat to the industry, but...
No, I don't think so. I think it's actually good for the industry in general,
mm-hmm.
Because all of a sudden people talk about beer again. Mm-hmm. And I mean, in order to accept that something has a certain value, you have to think about it and you have to talk about it. And the German beer market over the last 30 years developed into a direction that nobody talked about the beer, about the attributes of the beer. Why would I buy this or that brand? Because it's special or whatnot. You would mainly find, especially in Northern Germany, you'd mainly find your Pilsners and your Hefeweizen, maybe some non-alcoholic and maybe Eastern German style Schwarzbier, black lager, and that would be it. You didn't find much variety, even if we still have, like in some regions like Cologne or Düsseldorf, you have your specialties, but they're typically there. I mean, you wouldn't find, I'm not judging Kölsch now because you're from Cologne, but you wouldn't find a good alt beer somewhere outside of Düsseldorf. You would find alt beer, but not a good one.
Yeah, well, not one that's produced there, you know, outside of Düsseldorf, right?
No, but even one. Well, you're talking about Diebels. You find a mass market alt beer,
but it's also like smaller breweries than.
You wouldn't get smaller, really authentic alt beers in Northern Germany. But even for that mass market, this one mass market alt beer, it would be still hard to find that in Northern. Well, 5 years, 6 years ago in Northern Germany, beer store. So people were just buying beer by price, so which is on sale at the moment, and that's how they would buy beer, and so that is changing with the whole craft beer, creative beer scene, so that people talk about the beers again, and so all of a sudden beer has a new value. So I also think that will help the overall beer market in Germany, because all of a sudden you can justify reasonable prices on the market.
Yeah. So going back to when you came back from the States, you started to, your first beer is called Prototype.
Yeah, Prototype, yeah.
And that is not your, I mean, from the style, from the taste and everything else, it's like the beer, but it's not the most obvious choice to make a lager when everybody's here is gearing up to drink super hopped IPAs, double, triple IPAs, whatever.
Yeah.
So the taste was more in the direction, let's get crazy experimenting with these new styles, and you decided to make something different.
Yeah, I mean, on one hand, in general, I do not just want to follow others. I want to create my own ideas just work of that. And of course, I'm a big hophead as well. And by now we do have also IPAs and double IPAs and extra brewed IPAs and West Coast IPAs. We have brewed all of them. However, to start with, I went back to a beer that inspired me a lot, well, a beer and a brewery as well, which is Sierra Nevada, and especially their Sierra Nevada Pale Ale was always my go-to beer when we were living in Miami. That was the beer that I always had in our fridge, because it has this perfect balance between a beer that is super drinkable. You can almost drink it. Lawnmower beer is always a bad word, but you know, you can even have you after working in the in your yard.
Lawnmower beer.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a bad word. I think it's a good word.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Yeah, it's typically,
I like having a beer with the mowing lawn.
Yeah, well, I think it's typically used, especially in the U.S., for like all the Bud and Miller Coors, thin, watery, fizzy yellow water beers. However, you're totally right. You can drink it out of the bottle just as a refreshment, as a thirst quencher, and it works great for that. Mm-hmm. It's not too bold or too complex for that. But at the same time, if you want to have a beer that has a certain backbone, a certain flavor, you can still drink it. You can pour it in a glass and enjoy it slowly, sip it, and still a great beer. Mm-hmm. It strikes that perfect balance. Plus, if you go back to the roots of the US craft beer scene, which on the larger scale started around 1980, also with Sierra Nevada and others, a lot of those brewers were looking at the European market and a lot of the traditional European beer styles, which some of them actually died out. So it was a lot of these breweries started with British styles like a pale ale, stout, porter, beers like that, and revived these beer styles by taking the idea of these recipes, but brewing them with American ingredients. And the American hops just have a pretty different flavor from to British hops. So it kind of was a new approach on an old style. So going back to when we started, that was the inspiration that I tried to take, saying, okay, I don't want to produce another IPA, especially not as the first beer to say, hello world, here we are, and we have another IPA. The few colleagues, I think it's like, I don't know, maybe somewhere between 5 and 10 small craft breweries were on the German market when we started. But I think all of them had as their flagship beer an IPA. Mm-hmm. It was like, nah, I just don't want to do that. So I said, okay, why don't we look at like something very traditional German, like a Helles Lager beer, using that as a base, but taking the inspiration of dry hopping, making that more interesting by dry hopping a lager, a Helles. So that's what we did. We used some of that very traditional made floor malt, which is really made on a huge old building where it's spread out over the floor and special tiles and has to be turned over a couple of times per day. It's very labor intensive, but it has a very nice flavor. And then we decided to dry hop the beer with a Czech hop variety, the Sarza, which I've used in the Caribbean before because it gives that sort of pseudo sweetness. It doesn't add sweetness, but it almost not as being really sweetness, but like the impression of sweetness to a beer, especially on a very light bodied beer, it gives more body to the beer. And on the other hand, we used Simcoe, a US hop variety that adds a lot of that super nice fruity passion fruit, lychee flavor to the beer.
So, but you add hops during the normal brewing process and then add more hops at the end?
On the cold hopping? Side. With the dry hopping. So typically, in classical brewing, you're adding hops during the boil. And at that stage, you're extracting the bitter compounds while the essential oils are actually being evaporated with the water that you evaporate during boiling. So you get the bitterness, but not much of the hop aroma. Mm-hmm. However, when you add the hops after the fermentation ends, so that is on the what we call cold side, so depending on the yeast strain that you're using, a top or bottom fermenting yeast, somewhere between 10 or 20 degrees C, that is between 50 and 70 Fahrenheit, something like that. Mm-hmm. You're adding the hops, so you're not extracting any bitter compounds, but you're extracting all the essential oils. And since you have like somewhere past 200 different hop varieties that are actually also depending on their flavor, depending on the terroir where they grew and under the conditions and the soil, there's a huge playing field to play around with hops and add flavor, different flavors to beer.
Yeah, sure.
So yeah, that's what we did. And so that's how Prototype evolved as like for many, many people, the entry level beer on the German beer market, because on one hand, it's not too far away for the traditional beer drinker that only knows his Pils and Hefeweizen from what he or she knew before. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, with the dry hopping, helps them to like open the door into the craft beer world.
Yeah.
If you would like one of our main IPAs have like 7.5% ABV, 65 bittering units. If you give a beer like that to someone who has never had craft beer before and just knew Pils and Hefeweizen,
he might just
like
die.
A slap in the face. Yeah, probably.
Just die. Yeah, but that's the thing. The variety, the possibilities that have, especially in Germany, have not been looked into at all because the market was so bland and boring. Nobody knows that because you're living in that market and you think you're like, hey, Germany is like the country where we invented everything, especially beer.
Yeah.
But so for me, when before how we met was that I was as an as somebody who traveled extensively the United States, part of my family moved there, lived there. So I was there when I was young. I always enjoy, and of course through the art, traveling to the art fairs, traveling to exhibitions in the United States, and always enjoying the huge variety of different beers that, I mean, as a German, I've never tasted these beers. So I come to a supermarket, I see beers that I haven't even heard. I mean, IPA, never heard of that. And you just pick out beer from the label and say, wow, this
probably
is
artwork.
From the artwork, you know, like that's the visual me, you know, coming over and saying, wow, this is amazing. I don't know. You know, and then tasting all these different beers. So when the last time I was in the United States, 2012, we traveled, my family and I, we traveled with an RV through the countryside, and every stop we made to buy supplies, I had my family buying all the stuff mm-hmm. that they gave me to cook later on, and I was just standing in front of these, you know, refrigerators, these, and I was just mesmerized, and I was like, okay, I take this one. And the next time I tried other stuff. So when I came back, I said, even when I was still traveling, I told Noah, I said, I have to get into this whole beer thing because we need different beers in Germany. And I knew that already a few people had started doing something, but not you couldn't foresee that, you know, actually something like this would happen. We're a very conservative country in many ways, especially when it comes to beer and football and stuff like that. So I found you by inquiring with people that knew a little bit about beer and beer market, and somebody recommended me to contact a former colleague from university.
University, yeah.
Yeah, and so we came together because he said, well, my friend Ollie is already doing this in Hamburg, so if you're in Hamburg,
give him a call,
you know?
That's what
that's how we met, and that's how we started getting into the idea of making, you know, interesting, different beers. And it took us some time, you know. I think you could call me, I don't want the official title, but you could call me an ambassador for Kevida. By promoting your beers, not promoting it officially on social media or through advertising, but all my friends had to go through this, and none of them said, I don't like it. Everybody was like, all right, okay, yeah, I'm okay. I tried. Some people were like, oh, yeah, amazing, I want that. Mm-hmm. But everybody, after they had their first prototype, none of them said, I'll never have this again.
So, yeah.
You know, it's... And so I think the opportunity, the possibilities are so big when you find, I mean, I didn't know much. I just wanted to change things and I wanted to take it in my hands to change things because that's something, sometimes there's something you have to do. But of course, I have enough on my plate, so it was a good, you know, everything happens for a reason. We met. I could have met somebody else who brews beer and said, okay, this guy, I help him brew his beer. I'll take his money, which I don't have, but I mean, I'll take his money. And let's see where he ends. He might have nice labels and just stupid beers. But that was not, you know, what happened. And I mentioned that earlier in our German podcast, when I come to you and we together we brew beer and we talk about all these things, it's like when I'm at your brewery, it's like as a kid, dream coming true, being locked into a toy store overnight. Because there's so much to discover and so much to see and so much to learn. With this beer, and I think that's a good point, good time to mention Scott.
Yeah.
You know, we mentioned him in the German podcast, but I think if he hears this, we should mention him because he is also part of this beer because he was there when we made the initial test.
That's right, yeah.
We tried everything out and maybe you can say something about Scott Jennings because that is something that we also don't have in Germany, people who try out things in beer. Except for the...
It's starting slowly, but it wasn't there for the longest time. Scott is a very good friend. We studied together back in 97-ish at the VLB in Berlin. Started brewing science. I took this whole, like, five-year German graduate engineer course, and Scott took this targeted at foreign brewers, so-called certified brewmaster course. He was there with his wife. Their first daughter was just born. Mm-hmm. And we spent a lot of time because I was always interested in, other cultures, people from somewhere else. Yeah. I'm always curious. So we spent a lot of time together while in Berlin, but then they, of course, moved back to the U.S. to look for a job, work at a brewery, and we kind of lost track. And, I don't know, probably 15 years later, probably about 15 years later, while I was doing this technical sales job in the U.S., one of the first breweries, of course, I visited was Sierra Nevada because... Mm-hmm. Well, it's also a very important player in the U.S. craft beer market. And Ken Grossman, the owner...
Also kind of the pioneer in many ways.
Definitely. Right? In many ways, yeah. They also have the new brewery is like the first LEED Platinum certified brewery building in the U.S. Mm-hmm. It's like super high, environmentally conscious. I could talk mm-hmm. probably an hour about what they're doing at the brewery. Yeah. It's a really great inspiration, I have to say. So anyways, Ken toured me through his brewery in Chico. That's Northern California, roughly 3 hours north of San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And so we came to their pilot plant, their pilot brew house, which still, if I could have that right now, I would just probably cut off a finger or stuff. And he introduced me to his pilot brewer, Scott Jennings. And both of us were like, I've seen you before. that was great to finally meet Scott again. Mm-hmm. And since then, I have been a guest at their place plenty of times. After we moved back to Germany, they visited us with their whole family. We went to their place because they moved over from Chico to Asheville, where mm-hmm. Sierra Nevada built their East Coast brewery. Mm-hmm. Where Scott moved on to be the head brewer of the whole brewery,
but as an experimental brewer, he that's basically what you're doing too, you know, just in your own brewery because you're trying stuff out. I mean, there's so many different kind of beers that are coming out. You know, we're having the Zeebrugge Grisette mm-hmm. that is already. I mean, I didn't even. You know, sort of. I just saw it when your distribution sent me the mail with the new beers that are available. You know, so I think that's part of what is so exciting about this whole scene and market right now is that it is very experimental. That young, well, not just by age, but I mean from the breweries, young breweries and brewmasters start to hear to develop something completely new and different. And with most of them, art has a place in that, and there's always a visual context. There's always an image with the beer. Like if you look at a Beck's, you know, for example, like one of the beers, it's, you know, has this traditional seal, and when they do advertising, it's on the river, on the sea. It's like a boat. It has green sails and stuff like that. It's boring. It's, I don't know. It was boring when they started doing this. It's got nothing to do with any imagination what, you know, around the beer. And now it's, if somebody does a beer and it has a certain title with most of, like, I don't know, Simon from Buddelship or so, his labels, they have got something to do with the beer, with the story he tries to convey with, you know, pushing this out. So so I think, okay, we're taking it a step further by including this in the whole process and starting from the beginning. And we're also just beginning. It's like the second beer that we're doing, and we're not just like, and you know, sort of.
Well, yes, as in this, at this level, at this stage.
I mean, with the very, it's, you know, second artist beer that we're
making. I mean, we have been doing a lot of other projects together.
Yeah, that's true.
Various projects with labels that you
it's the first time that both for. Things really come together.
Yeah, that's right.
And and for me, it's when you look at the art market has changed these last years significantly from, I mean, I'm, you know, I'm an artist for many, many years. I'm in the art world for many years, but I'm running a gallery as a business for 16 now. And in these 16 years, so many things have changed from the beginning when people were like, you make a gallery, everybody's invited, you know, things like that. Or you exhibit artists that haven't studied, you know, but yeah, but they're doing, you know, work on the street for like 15 years, you know, what kind of different schools that, stuff like that. And just looking into the work, and it worked out. And people started to love that. We've been invited to big art fairs, you know, sort of our artists were celebrated, we're celebrated to a point where there was a lot of money spent on a new kind of art. Two, there was no money spent at all anymore because the market fell totally apart. Two, a place where we're now, which is so oversaturated, and where, well, I think we're already in the third generation of graffiti. These young kids don't even know who started the whole thing.
Right.
You know, and if they knew, they would respect this. I'm not blaming these kids for it, but it's just they go on Instagram and they see great artwork and they see people who have 30,000 followers and they follow these people because they think they do something different, but they only have followers. You know, it's like different values, different currencies that are in place. It's a very oversaturated in every way, so you have to kind of stop. Hold on. One of the reasons I'm doing the podcast is we can talk for an hour and people, they would, and are interested, listen for an hour.
Right.
Just amazing. Yeah. Listening for an hour. No matter what you do, you work out, you do exercise, you're on a bike, you're in a car, you're in a traffic
That's
jam,
what
whatever.
I typically do.
Exactly. So, but you listen, you know, and I think this is the same thing that I like about these projects that we do with the beer. There are many hands involved, many people involved. We have like the print. I'm not doing this print. I'm doing the artwork for the print.
Right.
But we have Dolly Demaretti from Mother Drucker in Berlin, who is, for me, the best printer that I've ever, you know,
sure,
so she does amazing work. But she also gets involved. So many people get involved and take time. And craft and making a beer is not just like the 2-3 days that we're actually hands on brewing the beer. It's all the preparation. It's everything that comes afterward. It's labeling every single fucking bottle. It's making the boxes. It's making, you know, just now today we spent some time just signing 100 prints.
Yeah.
You know, so, and that's what I like about this kind of project. It's not just about a drink. And a great label artwork. It's about just stop for a minute, you know, see and appreciate the time that people spend on certain things to get to a point, you know, and it's not marketing driven or anything. Of course, we like this to sell out on the first night, but we don't mind if it doesn't. Also, even if it sells out, you know, it's not a new roof for a house or something. It's no holiday with the kids. It's just like
to be honest, I mean, especially from the brewing perspective, beers like that are great for awareness, for reputation. You're not making money with these beers. Too complicated. The amount of the small batch projects with the amount of work and special ingredients you're putting in there. Actually, you will typically price them that you cover cost, mm-hmm. Which is fine. Sure. And of course, you're not. That's why the limited. You're not doing these on a daily basis. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a business. It mm-hmm. doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
But they're great for many reasons. From my point of view, on one hand, it's fun. I always mm-hmm. like to stay on my toes to just like play around, try something new, especially these cross-border collaboration projects. Are always a new inspiration. They open your mind. We do have other collaboration projects with other brewers, which mm-hmm. is also great and amazing. But it's in a way just being at another brewery. Mm-hmm. You still learn, you still pick up new ideas, but every now and then you have to look beyond. And that's great, whether we work with Coffee Roasters or in this case, this I think it's actually taken it really a step further because you're getting out of that whole food thing mm-hmm. Into something new and trying to feel your way into, well, on one hand, your approach on art or a specific, well, initially song that inspired installation art carving, and then again taking that and trying to get the inspiration for a beer,
mm-hmm.
And that makes you think and play around, and that's really the amazing part for doing that. And of course, friendship. I mean, because it's just fun to hang around with good guys like you and do crazy stuff just yeah. because we can, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Actually, he's talking about Ken. Can I get another beer?
Of course.
You get one for a while.
The fridge at Helium Cowboy is always full, unless I drank it all. I'll have another one too. Yeah. So. One recommendation is that sort of everyone who listens to this or drinks the beer should definitely listen to the song, "The Love Me or Die." I think there's no other song by that name, so if you Google that or the amazing CW Stone King, then you'll find that song pretty quickly as well. Yeah, you can actually listen to all his songs, but I mean, start with this one. Did you forget anything else? We talked before, now you had like 3 hours to think about. Ollie Vesalo is the world champion of beer sommeliers. It's the same word in English, right? Beer
sommeliers.
That's right. Yeah. So that means he knows a lot about taste and what kind of, beer and, what matches what and whatever. So, and food pairing is one part of that. We talked about that earlier. And with the first beer we did, the Dirty Hands of Alex Diamond, it's kind of simpler.
Yeah, it's a smoked talking about that beer, smoked porter, mm-hmm. Aged on wood chips, which is I think more straightforward in a food pairing, which just from the top of my head would probably combine with wild meat, deer, maybe boar, lamb. Something like that has more a robust character. The beer itself is robust. It's a big beer. It will dominate a lot.
Well, for vegan friends, any alternative to that? No. Okay, sorry.
You get the next challenge there.
Yeah.
Vegan.
Yeah, wouldn't work.
Vegetarian might be something, but vegan.
Yeah, vegan will work.
All right, I put that on my bucket list to think about.
Put that on the list of things that probably next world champions of sommeliers yeah. have to think about.
Actually, I was talking to a chef the other day, joking around, saying, "Well, it would be a great idea." The chef, the great Oliver Trifick, mm-hmm. who ran really good. Restaurant for a long time. He just regrettably, really, really regrettably had to close down because, again, one of these things when people create art, in this case, food,
mm-hmm.
And they do it with a lot of passion and really go in with love to detail, it's tough to get enough people to appreciate the value of that and pay for that.
Mm-hmm.
So we're glad to be here to close down. Maybe he has the time now to work on that project because we said, well, it would be great to develop a complete beer menu, be it pairing menu for vegan for a vegan restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
That would be great. So that's my next challenge. So that's coming up.
Okay.
Yeah, but back to the Love Me or Die. This is yeah, it didn't really pop up in my mind yet. I will still think about it. But
we'll write it in the show notes when you.
Yeah, it would be. This is one of the things I always love sitting down with chefs.
Yeah.
Because they're, well, artists in flavor.
Yeah.
And even though a lot of them just drink beer but don't know much about beer, mm-hmm. but once they. Taste to be with them mm-hmm. there, you know, flavor machine starts and as you talk and they come up with different ideas, they know how to match flavors and spices and ingredients perfectly.
So,
so that might be interesting to sit over a Love Me or Die with a chef to figure that out, because it's very two-sided with that sweetness and the bitterness.
So I think that's something we should actually be able to manage. You know, we know so many chefs. We'll find one.
From the top of my head, it's not a complete dish, but something with rhubarb might work, because you have that slight acidity in the rhubarb.
Yeah, was it? See, there's something I would never thought.
There's a lot of elements that you would get together.
Okay,
I'm still working on that.
All right, rhubarb and fish maybe. Yeah, I don't know. I think we've covered
most of it.
Most of it. It's always impossible to cover everything, but it's also about trying to find the stories that might interest other people than the two of us. But I think we covered that one, and we'll see. We don't force anyone to drink our beer. We don't force anyone to listen to this podcast. We're happy when you do both, of course.
Exactly. I think there's still the opportunity once you post it online. Hey, if anyone has questions to what we said, I don't know, just post it below the podcast and we'll try our best to add answers to that later.
Well, that's the thing. I think it's still this podcast is still too much of a baby that I really get much feedback on it. But I see that many people listening to it. Actually, I'm super surprised how many people listen to this. I'm really happy about that part. But there's hardly any kind of feedback, people writing, I like that, or, have questions about
it. Maybe that's the first one.
But maybe this one,
please feel inspired to bring out your comments and questions.
Exactly. All right. So, Ollie, cheers.
Oop, that didn't sound well.
Hold on. It's actually glasses this guy designed, I mean, they should actually sound.
It still sounds weird. Whatever.
Still nice glasses.
Still nice glass, and it's made not for the sound, but for the tasting.
Yeah. So,
thanks for listening, and cheers.
All right, that was that. The Beer and Art Podcast with my man Oliver Vesselow, Part 2. The first part was the German version we recorded right before this one, and I'm so glad we did it. There's one more thing I need to say though. Only recently I have been criticized harshly for the background music of Helium Talk. And well, if you know me or my taste in music, you know that I'm not the biggest fan of it myself. But there's always only so much time, and even though I'd love to change it, I didn't have a chance to get to improve it myself until now. So if you want to contribute music that fits better with this podcast, I'd be happy to hear from you. Just drop me a mail at heliumtalk@heliumcorway.com. Thank you and goodbye for now.